Coming up 6 weeks after Hurricane Matthew slammed into Haiti, Kim Lawton travels there for an update on faith-based relief efforts. Also, Tim O'Brien on why the U.S. has so many people in prison, 12.3 million, a higher rate than in any other country in the developed world. And a cafeteria in Boone, North Carolina, where feeding the hungry is the mission.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Religious groups are among those reacting to President-elect Donald Trump's new administration appointments. Early in the week, Trump's selection of Breitbart News executive Steve Bannon as chief strategist provoked a flurry of response. Many faith groups objected, citing material on Bannon's website against Jews, Muslims, and others. But the conservative Faith and Freedom Coalition praised the appointment as being practical and results-oriented. Religious leaders have been speaking out against a spate of post-election incidents of hate crimes, harassment, and graffiti against minorities in some houses of worship. On Friday in Washington, Christian and Jewish leaders joined Muslims at the Masjid Muhammad, known as the nation's mosque, to demonstrate interfaith solidarity. The group called on the incoming administration to protect the religious liberty of all people and to defend Muslims against violence and discrimination.
We're here to say loud and clear that people of different backgrounds stand with American Muslims against any form of bigotry and discrimination, and that we're ready to work with our leaders, including the incoming administration, on efforts to uphold the value and dignity of all people in our nation and to uphold our national ideals of religious freedom for all.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, which gathered in Baltimore this week for its annual fall meeting, called on Trump and the new administration to recognize the contributions of refugees and immigrants to the overall prosperity and well-being of our nation. A new study presented to the bishops noted that more than half of U.S. Catholics born since 1982, 54%, are Latino. The bishops elected a Latino to a key role for the first time. Mexican-born Archbishop Jose Gomez of the Los Angeles Archdiocese was elected vice president of the conference. Cardinal Daniel DiNardo of the Archdiocese of Galveston, Houston, was named the new president. DiNardo spoke about the importance of Catholics coming together, especially in light of the tensions from the nation's recent election.
I would want our work as shepherds and leaders to bring Catholics together to recognize the beauty of the human person, even someone who disagrees with you. Pope Francis has called the entire church to extend mercy as we have received mercy.
This past week, Pope Francis celebrated a Mass for some 6,000 poor and homeless. The special guests came from a dozen European countries and Africa. At the Mass, the Pope bluntly addressed the more well-off in society, saying, "There's no peace in the homes of the prosperous as long as justice is lacking in the home of everyone." The Mass was one of the last events commemorating the Pope's Year of Mercy, which ends this weekend. Francis has said he hopes Catholics will continue to focus on acts of mercy. Also this weekend, Francis is elevating 17 new cardinals, including three from the U.S. There are signs that religious leaders and Native Americans protesting the construction of a $3.8 billion pipeline in North Dakota are having an effect. The Army Corps of Engineers has agreed to delay the construction of the pipeline until further studies are completed. Indian tribes say the Dakota Access Pipeline would threaten drinking water and sites sacred to them. Meanwhile, in Montana, the government and Devon Energy agreed to cancel leases for oil and gas drilling on lands considered sacred by the Blackfeet tribe. On October 4th, Hurricane Matthew slammed into Haiti, killing hundreds and leaving widespread destruction in its wake. Urgent humanitarian needs remain. Kim Lawton has our report from Haiti on faith-based aid efforts in the midst of the crisis.
Across Haiti's southwestern tier, Hurricane Matthew's massive destructive path is still all too evident.
The damage was extensive across the southern peninsula, destroying crops, tearing roofs off houses, destroying livestock and fishing boats, everything in its path.
Christopher Bessie is the Haiti country representative for Catholic Relief Services, one of many faith-based groups here providing help. For the last 6 weeks, CRS has been distributing emergency supplies, including food, clean water, tarps, and temporary shelters.
We're still doing distributions, but we're shifting to a phase of recovery. We're looking at how these tarps can be replaced with repairs to houses, get roofs back onto houses, and get people's livelihoods up and running again.
Bessie says nearly 1.5 million Haitians are still in need of urgent humanitarian assistance. One major concern is the lack of access to clean water and sanitation. In the wake of Matthew, cholera cases have been on the rise. Relief workers here are also very worried about Matthew's impact on Haiti's food supply, both now and in the months to come. The hardest hit area is considered one of the country's main breadbaskets. The storm destroyed a huge percentage of food-producing trees, crops, and gardens. CRS's incoming president, Sean Callahan, says seed supplies were also decimated.
There was going to be a harvest coming up in December, and they will have lost that. And so they were going to be planting in November now, and we're hopeful that if we can get some supplies out so that they can plant now with seeds, that they'll have a harvest in April. So if they miss that, then they've got 6 or 8 months now that they would be without food.
CRS is setting up a seed voucher program and helping to fix irrigation systems so that farmers will still be able to plant crops. These farmers, who will be part of the program, were already starting to prepare their fields. CRS and other relief groups say they face several challenges in their efforts. One is a tenuous security situation. In some areas, people are so desperate that riots have broken out during aid distributions. Supply trucks have been ambushed and looted.
The insecurity leads to delays in our distributions and delays in our programs, which creates more frustration and more insecurity.
Another challenge is not having adequate resources to address the many needs. Workers here say that forces them to make some difficult decisions.
It's hard to, if you only have resources for 1,000 families and there's 4,000 families in need, it's heartbreaking to have to say, no, you don't quite make the cut. I know that, you know, you lost X, Y, and Z and you don't have food to eat, but this family hasn't eaten for 2 days, so we're going to respond to that.
Callahan was visiting from CRS headquarters in Baltimore. He says while they've received many donations for their Haiti work, he's nonetheless concerned that the situation isn't on more radar screens.
Many people have somewhat forgotten about the crisis that's occurred here in Haiti. I think because of the 65 million displaced people around the world and the U.S. election, people have forgotten about it. And so part of my job is, one, to come back and bring that message to people in the United States to let them know that there are still people that need some assistance here.
The current crisis hit as Haiti was still struggling to recover from the devastating 2010 earthquake. The nation is overwhelmingly Christian. According to official estimates, 80% of Haitians are Catholic, although experts say Protestants have made significant inroads. The Vatican's ambassador to Haiti, Archbishop Eugene Nugent, says churches have been playing an important role in the recovery effort, even though many themselves were damaged.
Whenever there's any problem, people always go to the church. They go to their local priest or their local pastor for aid, for advice. And that is the case at the moment. So that is the immediate role, is to provide encouragement, immediate humanitarian assistance. And that has been ongoing for the past month or so.
The Archbishop says he's been inspired by the faith and resilience of so many Haitians.
In the history of Haiti, the country has known so much trouble, so much disasters, so much political upheaval. And yet the people have a great sense of hope in spite of all the difficulties, in spite of all the problems.
And indeed, many here tell us that faith and hope will be key in getting through yet another crisis. I'm Kim Lawton in Port-au-Prince.
We have a special report now on the mass incarceration in this country. 2.3 million Americans are in prison, the highest rate of any other country in the developed world. And many prison sentences are much longer than they would be in other countries for the same offense. Correspondent Tim O'Brien reports.
Much of the growth in the prison population can be traced to the war on drugs that took on steam in the early days of the Reagan administration.
Just say no.
Congress and the states followed up, passing laws mandating lengthy prison terms for mere possession, including for many young people who themselves posed no threat of violence. The resulting overcrowding gave birth to a private prison industry driven by lobbyists with a vested interest in building new prisons. There was also a spike in street crime starting in the late 60s, which helped Richard Nixon win the White House in 1968. And helped Michael Dukakis, portrayed as soft on crime, lose the election 20 years later.
Weekend prison passes, Dukakis on crime.
Candidates for national office ever since have been hawking their bona fides as crime fighters.
I am the law and order candidate.
While the United States has the highest incarceration rate in the civilized world, here in Dearborn County, Indiana, the heartland, they may have the highest incarceration rate in the United States. They send more people to prison here than they do in San Francisco, which has 13 times as many people. The numbers are a source of pride to County Prosecutor Aaron Negengard.
We hold people accountable to the law, and I think that's the way it should be. And now not everybody agrees with that.
There's not much violent crime here. It's a peaceful community, 97% white, that sits along the Ohio River, 20 miles west of Cincinnati. But Dearborn County reflects a phenomenon that is sweeping suburban and rural counties throughout the country, an epidemic of heroin and opioid addiction that cuts across all socioeconomic lines.
There's nobody in prison who's not dangerous. If they're a drug addict, you got to have a lot of money to support a drug habit. They're stealing. They're burglarizing. They're neglecting their kids if they have them. They're operating while impaired. This is going on if you have a drug addict who's not in recovery. And so
why not send them to recovery and send them to prison?
You know, that's a great point. And we do. But if there's no threat of prison, they don't take recovery.
Perhaps it is not surprising so many Americans are in prison. We also have one of the highest murder rates in the world. Mark Maurer, longtime head of the Sentencing Project, is one of the country's leading experts on sentencing policy.
We do have a higher rate of violence, not crime, but a higher rate of violence in other industrialized nations. Some of that, our high murder rate, is related to the widespread availability of guns. So if you compare our rate of murder, homicide, to other nations, about half the differential between us and those other nations is due to the easy availability of firearms.
But it is not just the easy availability of firearms that distinguishes America from our European neighbors or explains why our incarceration rate is more than three times higher. Yale law professor James Whitman, in his critically acclaimed book, Harsh Justice, says Americans simply do not share the sense of human dignity that their forebears historically bestowed even on those who committed horrible crimes.
If you go back to the 18th century, before the American Revolution, before the French Revolution, what you discover is that there were two tracks of punishment. There was punishment for high-status people and punishment for low-status people. The most famous example involves the death penalty. High-status people had their heads cut off. Low-status persons were hanged. Hanging was much more shameful. But it wasn't only true of the death penalty. Much more broadly, high-status persons were treated respectfully. They were confined in what were called forms of fortress confinement. They were placed in apartments where they were given books to read. They had visits from their friends. They could expect fine food and decent treatment, whereas low-status persons were effectively subjected to slavery, a kind of death sentence in itself. What's happened remarkably over the last couple of centuries is that in continental Europe in particular, the old high-status forms of treatment have been generalized to all convicts in Europe so that everyone is now treated decently. We saw this most recently in the case involving Anders Breivik, the horrific mass murderer in Norway.
Anders Breivik, a self-proclaimed neo-Nazi, murdered 77 people in two separate attacks in Norway in 2011.
Who, as you may have read, is being housed in a three-room apartment with all sorts of conveniences and equipment. That sort of treatment, even of a man who committed an extraordinarily horrific kind of that type, is considered necessary for maintaining values of human dignity in Europe. By contrast, the old high-status forms of treatment have entirely vanished in the United States. As we all know, detention in an American prison is an extraordinarily degrading experience.
What about retribution?
I'll tell you, I think retribution, honestly, in the last analysis, is for the good Lord and not for the American government.
That might be a tough sell for many Americans who cite retribution as the primary reason they support capital punishment. In most of Europe, which doesn't have the death penalty, only the most dangerous offenders go to prison, and rehabilitation is a high priority. In the United States, by contrast, the primary goals seem to be retribution and deterrence. To Mark Maurer, it is a case of limited resources aggravated by mistaken priorities.
If we reverse priorities, scale back the use of prison, that would free up enormous resources first to invest in prevention treatment for teenagers, the 14, 15, 16-year-olds who are beginning to get into trouble. That's the time we need to be intervening. For those adults who don't need to be in prison, then we need to supervise in the community but address the underlying issues that got them there. So if it's poor education, if it's substance abuse, if it's mental health issues, that's where we need to provide the treatment, the services they need, not because it's a liberal do-gooder thing to do, because it's the right thing to do and it's more likely to prevent crime in the future.
But does the current practice of sending criminals away for lengthy prison terms, as they do in Dearborn County, Indiana, actually reduce crime? Professor Whitman has no doubts that it does.
The kind of large-scale detention that we have in the U.S. cuts down on violent crime rates. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And I'll say that my view is that incarceration certainly ought to be used to protect the general public. Offenders who really present a danger to their fellow citizens have to be kept off the streets. There's no doubt about that. The great problem in American law, though, is that we don't really take seriously what that sort of dangerousness calculus would require. For example, if we're really worried about dangerous offenders, there's no reason to keep them locked up until they're 90 years old.
Prosecutor Neggengard counts among his heroes the Scottish economist Adam Smith, who wrote, "Mercy to the guilty is cruelty to the innocent." To Professor Whitman and others, it is less about who is being punished than who is doing the punishing.
The way a society manages its criminal justice system is a test of the society's decency. Winston Churchill very famously said that to know whether you're dealing with a decent society, you should look first at its criminal justice system.
There does seem to be a developing consensus among liberals and many conservatives that lengthy prison terms, once thought to be a quick fix for violent crime, is neither.
You can see very intelligent and thoughtful representatives from both sides of the aisle talking about the need for sentencing reform, be it for issues related to dignity and humanity and respect for a person's ability to succeed again after committing a crime. And at the other end of the equation, you can talk about people saying, it makes no sense economically. It is a bad investment. Continuing to build prisons and continuing to keep people in prison for so long and then getting terrible recidivism rates, it's a government program that doesn't work.
Yet given America's apparent thirst for retribution, the crime problem that continues to plague the country, and the perception that getting tough on crime wins votes, any road to meaningful sentencing reform could be long and steep. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Tim O'Brien in Washington.
This week, highly respected and much-loved PBS anchor Gwen Ifill died of cancer at the age of 61. And Cliff Barrows, the musical director of Billy Graham's Crusades for more than 60 years, died at the age of 93. The National Book Awards were given out this week, and one of this year's winners was Congressman and Pastor John Lewis. Lewis recalled that when he was 16, he couldn't get a library card because he was told they were for whites only. Now, he and two co-authors have been honored for their young adult graphic novel about the civil rights era. Finally, in Boone, North Carolina, there's a remarkable place to eat good food called the Farm Cafe. Executive chef Renee Bauman had a calling 5 years ago to feed the hungry. So that's what she does. There's lunch for anyone, and if you can pay for it, fine. If you can't, you can do volunteer work in exchange for a meal.
FARM stands for Feed All Regardless of Means, and that is the community cafe concept that we employ here at the cafe. What that means is everybody that comes in the door is entitled to a meal. What we like to do is involve them in communities. I really feel like this place allows you the chance to practice being human, because it's not easy to be human and understand what that means in the full humanity of spirit, taking care of each other.
I'm good with that.
This is an opportunity for people to help their neighbors have a meal who might be down on their luck, cannot exchange cash for a meal. And so when they come in, if someone says, I'd like to have a meal, but I don't have any money today, we say, would you like to volunteer for an hour for your meal? Well, the volunteer jobs can be anything from helping us to set up in the morning, helping us sweep, take down chairs, help us take out the trash. When someone's been with us for a while and we've gotten used to what their skill set is, we actually have volunteers who might cook with us. We have volunteers who can help us even in the afternoon with breaking down. So it can be anything that a regular restaurant does. We do a buffet style service. So we have a small plate and a lunch plate. And we have about 7 items on the menu every day, from 2 soups to a salad. Then we'll have an entree, side dishes, dessert, coffee. And we ask for $10 as suggested donation for the lunch plate, $7 suggested donation for the small plate. Basically, that suggested donation on an average takes care of the cost of the food. People often ask me, well, how much money did you get from the town? When I didn't get any because I didn't ask for any. When someone comes in the door, it's all based on honesty. It's all based on what they tell you. If they say, I need a meal, that's it. I don't ask how many's in your family, what's your income. We just say, step up and enjoy the food. We do buy all our food. 95% of our food is purchased. A lot of people think it's donated. It's not, although we do get some valuable donations. It's important to us that the food is very good. We get a lot of local food. We buy from local farms. We buy meats from local family farm up the street. We want to make sure that everybody understands that their dignity is attached to their meal. I'm very much at a place, and I think a lot of the folks in my faith community are the same, where it's how do you live your life? It's not so much what's the chalkboard of what you believe. I mean, whatever people believe, you know, that's the issue for them. But it's how do you live your life in relationship to that faith? It's so thrilling to share that with everyone, and that especially those who might be in need who have eaten a lot of processed food, and they get excited about it. It's great. That's important to us, though, that everybody feels that sense of coming to the table together, dining together, sharing the meal together. You know, if there's any faith component to it for me, a lot of it has to do with that, just sitting down together and being able to exchange our lives.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. Have a happy Thanksgiving. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you, vintage footage of Cliff Barrows, Billy Graham, and the late George Beverly Shea singing This Little Light of Mine.
Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. Hide it under a bushel. No, I'm going to let it shine. Hide it under a bushel. No, I'm going to let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. This little light of mine.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.